Hi, I'm Tara.
And I'm Steph.
And we're from Kobo Writing Life, Kobo's free, fast, and easy self-publishing platform. KWL was built by authors for authors, and our team of dedicated book lovers is always working hard to help authors reach new readers around the world.
With Kobo Writing Life, authors can now publish audiobooks and ebooks right in their KWL account. We don't ask for exclusivity, and you'll always control your pricing in up to 16 currencies. You can also create a pre-order for your audio and ebooks with no date limitations.
We have a lot of great promotional opportunities for Kobo Writing Life authors available in the Promotions tab right in their KWL dashboard. If you're an author and you don't have access to the Promotions or Audiobooks tab, email us at writinglife@kobo.com and we'll get you sorted. We're all about providing excellent support.
Create your free account today at kobo.com/writinglife. If you want to learn more about Kobo Writing Life, check out our blog, podcast, and find us on social. Happy writing!
Whether you are traditionally published or indie, writing a good book is only the first step in becoming a successful author. The days of just turning a manuscript into your editor and walking away are gone. If you want to succeed in today's publishing world, you need to understand every aspect of the business: editing, formatting, marketing, contracts. It all starts with a good book. Then the real work begins. Join international best-selling author J.D. Barker and indie powerhouse Jay Thorne as they gain unique insight and valuable advice from the most prolific and accomplished authors in the business. The publishing world is changing, adapting. Do you have what it takes to become a full-time writer? If you're willing to do the work, we'll give you the tools. Get your notepad out, school's in session. This is Writer's Inc.
J.D., when's the porch going to be done?
I actually gave these guys a deadline. Like when they came in here, they said, oh, it's going to be 3 weeks from start to finish. And they started April 2nd. And like they're still out there. So I gave them an email on Friday or sent them one and just said, you've got until next Friday. If you're not done, as far as I'm concerned, you've abandoned the project and I'm going to hire somebody else. And they've had people out there all this week. So I'm hoping that they can wrap it up because I really want these guys out of here. So yeah, if you hear some banging, that's what's going on. They're right outside my office window right now.
You got to finish it while you still have good weather left this season.
That's the thing. Yeah, like, well, we've got all these other projects that are backing up. Like, they have to get done before the garage people can come in and finish what they need to do. And my wife wants to convert her old garage into a gym, and that can't happen until we're out of the old garage. And so it's like this domino effect. Like, everything is just kind of sitting there. And if snow hits the ground, then we're screwed. We have to wait until next year because it's too cold and nobody's going to do anything out there. So we'll see. Speaking of wives, I just got a text from her. Like she's got a Jeep Wrangler right now, and her lease is up in I think like another month and a half. So she's been out car shopping. She just sent me a picture of a Porsche 911.
family
car. Well, she's always had sports cars, you know. So that was kind of her thing. She's always had manual transmissions. Like her father taught her on a manual when she was 15, 16, and that's what she's always had. So she's always had fast sports cars. And then we had a baby, and obviously it's tricky to put a car seat in a Miata or a two-seater. So we ended up getting the Jeep Wrangler just to give her something, that felt a little sporty, but it had some room in it. But she's jonesing for that sports car again. And like, I know she was looking at like SUVs and stuff like that, but I think the whole idea of going into any kind of minivan mom car is just like scaring the crap out of her. So she found the 911s actually have a back seat. So she's all stoked about that, but we'll see. she may be pulling up in a 911 sometime soon. Her little real estate business, a portion of the Barker household, is doing really well. So
it must be. I was going to say, business must be good in the Barker household.
A lot of people renting cabins in Tennessee. don't know why.
Is that you, Zach? Are you renting out the property down there?
No, it's not me. I love going there, though. I love Gatlinburg. I haven't been in a long time. But it's a super popular spot, so it doesn't surprise me that your cabin is renting out a lot. So,
well, one of the things we've noticed, and I don't want to get too far into the Bigger Pockets real estate podcast here, but we've got a pool that's inside the cabin, so it's like it's an indoor pool, and that's huge from a rental standpoint. Like, that's what's getting us the bookings, and the pool cabins actually sell for an outrageous amount of money. And one of the things we were talking about last night is just buying cabins that don't have them and putting pools on them and then flipping them. Because for whatever reason, the investors in that area haven't seemed to figure out that you can add a pool after the house has been built.
Until like now.
Now they all know. But, that's like a $30,000 or $40,000 expense.
Crossover audience we got.
Yeah. Well, one of these days we have to have some type of show about the finances of being a writer and what you should do with your money when it actually comes in. Like, I've mentioned before, we do a lot of passive income type stuff and real estate and investing and things like that. And, if I didn't sell any more books, we could live off of all that. And I think it's really important to have that kind of financial stability.
That won't be a divisive episode at all.
Not at all.
It's funny, my buddy David, who I was kind of, I recommend you two to talk to about your cabins. When I told him about the place you got, I think I showed it to him. And he was like, well, I hope he has good luck with that because that is a party house. That was his first thing he said. He was like, that is a party house. That's not like a place where families would go. So you might be dealing with some damage at some point.
She's pretty good at screening out the riffraff. Like it says on the ad, it sleeps, I think, 10 people. And like we had somebody that contacted her the other day and he was like, well, can we get 17 in there? I'm like, no, it sleeps 10.
Was it Jay?
10.
Because that's about how many we try to get for our riding retreats.
it was the exact number. It was all the kids. We've been looking at, I didn't realize what kind of market this really is. We've been looking in Orlando too, and some of the places down there are crazy. Like the houses are themed, which I never even considered before. But like we saw one, a real estate agent sent us the pictures of it. It had four bedrooms. One of them had a Harry Potter bedroom, and like it literally looked like you were standing in the Harry Potter set. Another bedroom was Star Wars. The pool outside was like in a cave with like all kinds of, you know, cool lighting and stuff going on. It looked like you were on a Disney ride, and apparently that's like a thing down there. So like people rent these houses, you know, rather than staying on Disney property. But they, you know, at this point, they expect them to be on par with a Disney property. So, yeah, it's a crazy, crazy world out there. But it's an easy way to make money.
It sounds like a Dracul merch tie-in there somehow.
Yeah. Well, yeah, somewhere near the foyer when they're coming in and out, I have to have like a little stand selling books and memorabilia and T-shirts. And, you know, just like the Disney ride, you get out of the car and they try to sell you something. We got to do the same thing.
Well, I was going to say, you could maybe rent out a room at your house you're in now. Like, you know, have you ever dreamed of staying at a house that always has construction going on? You know, you could have like Bob the Builder in there and stuff.
The construction ride. You never know. It's worth a shot. And anyway, back to what we're supposed to be talking about.
Yeah, what's this podcast about? We're supposed to talk about books, right?
It's about film and TV, right? Because I wanted to throw a shout out to Grady. I noticed that Charlize Theron just attached herself to the final girl support group, movie or TV show. I'm not sure which one it is. She was listed as an executive producer, though.
Nice.
I've got a subscription to IMDb Pro, so like all these things kind of pop up on there, and I saw it day before yesterday. So congrats, Grady, if you're listening. That's awesome.
Nice. Also related, want to mention that if you listen to the show on iTunes and notice that last Monday, Riley Sager's episode was not appearing in iTunes until Tuesday, why don't you email Apple and let them know that you're not too happy about that? Because we distribute the podcast the same way every week. I hit all platforms, RSS feeds, websites, except for Apple. Went through Apple support and got the canned response that said, thanks, you know, expect episodes update after 24 hours. So who knows what happened. It's not the first time it's happened to us. It's not the first time I've heard people say there've been problems delaying episodes on Apple. We just want to make it clear that we have nothing against Riley. We were not trying to deep six his episode. That it was everywhere else but iTunes. So sorry about that, and hopefully it doesn't happen again.
All righty, we gotta love Apple. Whole place went to crap since Steve Jobs died, I guess.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's take care of some business, and then we're gonna get into the questions for this week. One quick mention before we get talk about Kobo is our friends Christine and JP have a really cool new podcast called The Serial Fiction Show at theserialfictionshow.com. Link will be in the show notes. It is focusing on Vella serials, and they have a cool idea. What they're doing is they're interviewing authors, but they have a companion podcast for just the writers. So on one episode, they talk about the story from the reader's perspective, and then on the other they talk to the author about how they created the series. So if you are interested in Vella or just serialized fiction in general, make sure you check out The Serial Fiction Show. Also, if you want to become a patron of the show, you can do that at patreon.com/writersincpodcast, and you can submit questions for our wonderful Q&A episode, which we're going to do today. Also want to give a shout out to our newest patron. I believe this is a username instead of a name, but this is Holger Nils Pohl. I think I got that. So Nils is probably his first name, I'm going to guess, but we'll go with the username on that one.
Don't make assumptions.
Yeah, I probably
his first name might be Holger or Holger.
Maybe.
Well, he's got a couple questions, so I'll probably pronounce it different here in a minute.
Well, cool.
He's busy hitting the delete key right now on
All right. Well, as the question asker, then, Mr. Bohannon, I'll turn it over to you.
Man, that was a terrible segue. So it's okay. So, all right. You guys ready to answer some questions here?
Bring it on. I'm totally caffeinated.
All right. So we're going to start off here with actually with a voicemail question from Chad Boyer.
Hey, guys. This is Chad. Here's a question that Jay gets to ask everybody else, and I figured I'd ask the three of you. Where do you think the publishing landscape is going to be in 5 years?
So, JD, let's start with you on that one.
TikTok, TikTok. I get asked this a lot, and every time I teach a class, like I just did the master class for Thriller Fest, you know, everybody's trying to figure out what's coming, and I see everything getting completely mashed together. Traditional publishing melding with indie publishing, and authors basically, I think a couple of years from now, because it's happening now, they're going to produce a book, they're going to hold it up, and they're going to say, where's the best place for this, and what's the best way to get it in front of people? And then it's just going to go from there, and you're going to see a hybrid model similar to what I do. You know, some traditional publishing on one particular novel, some indie publishing on possibly the same novel in other countries. But it's going to be a complete mishmash of those different things. I think like that's I know in my world that's where I'm going. As I look at every book, like I just went through the spreadsheet with my agent, and you know I'm in 150 different countries, which is roughly about 25 to 30 languages. We just went through each of those languages, and you know we figured out where she's at as far as selling it in territories where it hasn't sold yet, and whatever's left, I'm out there looking for translators and trying to find out a way to get it out on my own. So, you know, we're kind of fine tuning a model there, you know, basically a year after publication, whatever she hasn't sold, I'm kind of stepping up and finding a way to fill those voids. But I see for myself anyway, that's where I see this going. And I'm talking to a lot of mid-list authors and a lot of authors, you know, even the ones that are doing very well, the ones you see on the New York Times list on a regular basis, and they're looking at that same thing. Because traditionally, one of the things that's very different is traditional publishing tends to focus on the launch of a book. Everything is geared towards that launch. They want to get as many pre-orders as possible. They want to see that huge spike of sales on those first couple of days, try and hit that New York Times list. And then within 2 or 3 weeks, all of that kind of fizzles and it either levels out or disappears. A lot of these traditional authors have books that have been out there for years where there's literally no marketing behind them, and they're trying to find some ways to make that happen. So they're either getting their rights back and finding ways to indie publish those novels or do something with them. But that's basically opening that entire world to those people. And you know, as everybody gets more accustomed to doing that, I think it's just going to become the norm.
What about you, Jay? You're the one who's always asking the questions.
So. I know. It's funny to have it turned around on me. I totally agree with what JD said. I would add too that I think there's going to be. I think publishing is going to, the definition of publishing is going to change too. And the way I'm envisioning that happening is that you'll have a story, and then that story will be quote unquote published in many different ways. It could be a very traditional novel. It could be a web serial. It could be a video game. It could be any number of things. I really think writing to the specific medium is going to be something that's going to gradually change. So, you know, the 80,000 word novel is an artifact of a time when that was the spine width that you had to have on the bookshelf in the bookstore. And we're clearly not in those times anymore. So I think that for me anyways, as an author, I'm thinking about the story I want to tell, and then how can I manifest that story, that same story, in different ways and in different formats.
Yeah, you know, I'll be a little ignorant and say that I don't look that far ahead. So it's kind of a weird thing to, and I don't think about it that much. I will say, you know, for me, like, there's going to be ways to publish things and still do what I'm doing, like, you know, and just kind of adapt with it. You know, it looks like if you look at the traditional side, obviously that's becoming smaller and smaller as these companies are just basically merging together. I think that's going to be interesting to watch. The other thing that I think is going to be really interesting to watch is going to be, it's only a matter of time before the subscription model just takes a hold of the books, because it's happening everywhere else. Like, you know, and it's, they're obviously out there right now, but I think that it's only a matter of time before people are dependent less on buying individual books and or more into a subscription model, just like they are with movies and music and NVIDIA, it's happening in video games even. Like, Microsoft's making a big push for that with Xbox. Like, it's just, that's inevitable to me. So that's one of the big things that I'm keeping my eye on. So, all right. So Kim Barton, she says, I'm struggling to find my voice for my newsletter. Any advice, or will it just take practice and trial and error? Jay, I want to go to you first for that one.
Yeah, this is a tricky question, because I'm not sure you should be looking for the voice. Like, I think it should be there. Like, my initial reaction is the newsletter is where you are just 100% you. Like, you talk about things that you like, you share things that you're interested in. Now, everyone has a different approach to what they send their mailing list. Some people will send more updates that are more promotional, like new books that are coming out of their own or of other authors, and other people will send very personal updates. But I think the point is, the takeaway for, or maybe the answer for Kim's question is, I think you're overthinking it if you're trying to craft a voice for your newsletter.
Yeah, you said what I was going to say. I was going to say, I think that it's just, you're kind of overthinking it, and it should just be your voice. So you nailed it. I don't really have anything to add. JD?
No, I totally agree. I mean, my favorite newsletter that I get is the one from Dean Koontz, and I get it two different formats. He still mails out a physical, like, pamphlet document like 4 or 5 times a year, which is awesome to just kind of get in the mail. But if you get his email newsletter, he writes that whole thing. You know, he sits down, he comes up with all the bad jokes all on his own, you know, and it's a personal letter from him to his fans. And to me, that's really cool, because I know how many people actually don't write their own, you know, once you get up into that traditional world. So it's nice to see him doing it. But yeah, you should definitely know, you know, I mean, at that point, you should have your own voice. I mean, you're really talking to your friends. Like, that's the way I tend to approach it when I write my own. I'm you know, I'm reaching out to the, you know, somebody I haven't talked to for a little while, and I'm writing them a letter. That's kind of how, where I'm at.
All right, so let's grab, Kim's got another good one here. We'll grab her other question too. Do you think it's worth the effort to create free stories to offer readers, especially prospective readers, as a marketing strategy? I don't mean just a reader magnet, but stories offered in addition to that. JD, I'm curious what your
Yeah, me too. I was going to ask him to go first on that one too.
You know, I see how well it works. I know you can use free stuff as a lead magnet to bring people in, but in my personal experience, every time I've done that, those same people expect to get everything else for free. So I tend to stay away from it. The closest that I've got going on to that right now is I've been doing a lot of giveaways through Goodreads. You know, with them being owned by Amazon, you can give away up to 100 eBooks, and it basically doesn't cost you anything other than the cost of the promotion, which I think is $120 or so. But you're not paying for those eBooks. And it works out on a couple different levels. Your book automatically gets shelved for these people as a, you know, to be read on their little list, which means they get notified anytime something happens with that book. So if it goes on sale or whatever, they get an email automatically from Goodreads telling them that. So that's very beneficial. It's constantly in their face. And also, when those 100 books drop, it actually impacts your ranking as if you just sold 100 books. So that's beneficial too. So I've been experimenting. I've been using She Has a Broken Thing Where Her Heart Should Be, and I've been giving away 100 a week just to see what it does, and it seems to be working really well. I mean, across the board, even the Kindle reads are up, you know, so that's about as close to that as I'll get. I don't think I would actually give away a novel anymore at this point, other than, you know, something like that where it's going to benefit me on the back end.
Nice. Jay, you got any thoughts on that?
Yeah. I really want to hear what you have to say too, Zach, because I think my position in this has been slowly changing. I'm not sure free ebooks are worth anything anymore. Like, 10 years ago, it was a special, like, oh, a free ebook. Like, that was special. There's nothing special about a free ebook now. And whether you're talking fiction or nonfiction, I don't know about you guys, but like, I probably have folders and folders of free books that I've downloaded or been gifted for getting on a mailing list that I never even open. Now, I say all that, and I have a free trilogy on jthorne.net, which is my giveaway. And I just don't, I don't think that's an attractive lead anymore. I don't think people who download that read it. Unfortunately, I don't know what the next thing is. Like, how do you, you know, what is the incentive to get someone on your list or to get prospective readers? And maybe it's, you know, what JD's talking about with some strategic giveaways. But like, I don't know. I think the old days of the free reader magnet on the website just aren't nearly as effective as they once were.
Well, let me just throw something out there. I mean, I think you have to take a step back and look at what it is you're really trying to accomplish. Are you trying to bring in people that are looking for a bargain, or are you trying to bring in people that want to read your next book? So I think if you put a book out there and it's for sale and they read it and they like it enough, they're going to want to pick up that next book. Like you want people that are scrambling when they close that cover looking for your next title. And you want those people, you know, if it's at a certain price point, like in my case, you know, most of my books are around 10 bucks. You know, if I do something for free, you know, somebody's going to be looking for something for free or at least on the cheap. You know, if they buy a book at $10, they like it a lot, they want another, you know, story, they want to hear my voice again, they're going to be okay with spending that extra $10. And I see that in my sales. So I know that works as well. You know, and I've done the other route too. I gave away copies of Forsaken for almost a year and bumped up my newsletter list and did all of that. But all it did was just cost me more to send out emails at that point. It didn't really impact my sales in any legitimate way.
The only ways I've been able to make free work for me is I do still think that the perma-free book one in a series still can work if you're wide. If you're now, I want to also say, if you're in Kindle Unlimited, don't do a perma-free book one. I get asked that all the time. That's a terrible strategy. Make sure your book one is also in Kindle Unlimited if all your other books are. But if you're going wide, and you have, especially if you have like a 5-6 book series, I still think perma-free book one can work, because I definitely saw a lot of read through on my series when I did that, especially if I did a promotion on that book one for free. The other thing is offering the so in my Empty Body series, I offer the second book for free for sign up from my mailing list. And that really works, because I get a lot of mailing list signups, and I feel like since people did just read the first book, and if they want to go the second, they will take the time to download it and then hopefully buy the other books in the series after that. And I have data that says that's what people do. So those two things work. But other than that, like, I mean, Jay and I even did like the bonus short story for a couple trilogies, you know, and I don't feel like that really got us a bunch of mailing list signups or people cared that much, you know. So yeah, those are the only two things that really worked for me. So all right, let's go to one of Chris Wills's questions here. He asked, what do each of you think are three necessary elements of a bestseller? And he's talking like 100,000 plus sales, ignoring author name, sales, and marketing. I don't know how you can ignore all those things, but they could be three things that stood out for you from a bestseller you have read, or three things you suggest one might try to include in a novel.
Well, that's a JD question.
That's definitely a JD question. Yeah.
I don't think I have the answer for that any more than anybody else would. I mean, I think everybody shoots for the same thing. It's got to be a strong cover. It's got to be, you know, a lot of buzz. I mean, ultimately, it's word of mouth that takes anything to the bestseller list for, you know, any reasonable amount of time. Or, you know, because otherwise, everything is just bought and paid for. You know, you can put $1 million behind a title. You can get it on the New York Times list by doing that. But the second week, it's not going to be there anymore unless people are reading it and they like it and they talk about it and tell their friends to buy it. So that's got to be the thing. I think right now, if you want to look at a real world example, go out there and take a look at TJ Newman and what's happening there. You know, this is a flight attendant who wrote a book standing in the back of a plane, sold it for, you know, millions of dollars, sold film rights for millions of dollars. That book debuted at number two on the list. That's no accident, because when a publisher pays that kind of money, they're obviously going to put a lot of money behind it to make sure it gets there so they can try to recoup. So it's important to get that big advance. You know, all these different things have to come together. You know, they've got a great title, they've got a great cover, and the back of the book blurb. One of the few things that I have noticed on bestsellers is if a back of the book blurb is very short, but is so concise, it makes you want to pick up that book, it's a winner. You know, like her back of the book blurb is very short. There's very little to it, but, you know, two or three sentences and you have to read that book. And Riley touched on this the other day. You know, he drills down, you know, when he sends his pitches to his editor, he drilled it down to six words for his latest book. You know, like he was able to describe it at that level. And, you know, I think the fact that he could do that, you know, that means that the hook is just that strong. And if the hook is that strong, I think everything else is going to trickle down and translate.
Yeah, I think just to add really quick and then we'll move to the next question, I think it's just important. There's no formula.
No, not at
there's,
all.
There's no bestseller formula. Like, it's just, it takes, echo what JD said, but, you know, there's also a lot of luck involved. I mean, that's just, yeah, that's, yeah.
Well, so. The thing is, everybody tries to figure out the formula in hindsight. And my wife went through this exercise when Gone Girl came out. If you looked at the year prior to Gone Girl, there were only a handful of books that came out with the word girl in the title. And after Gone Girl, the following year, there were 400 of them. Everybody looks at that. They try to create a formula where there really isn't one, and then they try to replicate it. And to a certain extent, it works because Girl on a Train, you know, that one came out right after. But, you know, again, a lot of things have to line up. It has to be a perfect storm.
For sure. All right, so let's go to Kristen Matthews says, what's the best piece of advice you have received or given in regards to writing? Jay?
Best? God, there's like 80 things running through my head as far as advice goes. I mean, I've been given this and I've given it, so I'll go with it. Like, writers write. And that just, it sounds so basic, but we've all met those writers who take all the courses, they watch all the videos, they listen to all the podcasts, they read all the books, but they don't do the writing. Like, you got to produce the words. It's just that simple. And maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but for me, I'd say that's the best or most common piece of advice I've given and received.
Yeah, that's true for sure. I mean, it's no different than going to the gym, right? Like, you're not going to get in shape unless you're actually there, you know, 4 or 5 times a week.
But you look cool walking in the door.
You do. The advice that hit home for me personally was James Patterson. He told me that at the top of every notepad that he uses on his monitor on his computer, he's got two words: be there. Like, he writes that down on everything before he actually starts writing. And I started doing that too. And like, if you just think about that, you know, you write a paragraph, you write a scene or whatever, you know, read through it. Does it feel like you are really in there in that moment, really living it with those characters? And if you don't feel that, then something's off and you've got to go back and revamp it. That's changed a lot about the way that I write for the better. So two words, I think, can definitely help. But, you know, like Jay said, you have to be there writing every day in order for any of that to make any difference.
I'll take a slightly different angle than y'all are and talk about advice that I like to give out, which, you know, anytime I get asked about how I was able to go full time, you know, most often people phrase it some way like, how did you start making enough money off your books where you could go full time? And I always tell them, I'm like, well, I think you're kind of asking the wrong question, because the advice I always like to give is, you know, you can't, how do I want to say this? Like, oftentimes it's easier to control the money you have going out than what you have coming in. So basically what I'm getting at is I tell people that a big reason I was able to go full time had way more to do with the fact that my wife and I got out of, like, we didn't have any debt or anything like that. And, you know, we just have a very low, like, the way we live is just super minimal. So I just, you know, you don't have to make as much money when you don't have as much going out. Like, I mean, we're comfortable and we're doing fine, but, you know, that's like the thing I try to tell people is just, you know, try to focus on what you can. Because for me, as we've talked about before, like, having my freedom is much more important to me than having a bunch of stuff and having things. So I guess that'd be my answer, to take a slightly different angle than y'all. So, and bring it back to the financial podcast we had going on earlier. Let's see. Let's do. We got a few more minutes here. We could probably get a couple more of these in. Holly Starkey, this is a good JD question. What are your recommendations for getting started in ghostwriting?
Oh, that, I get that a lot. And, you know, like, I've talked about how I got into it, and I fell into that. Like, it wasn't, you know, like a career that I pursued or anything like that. I mean, I was just really good at correcting punctuation and grammar, and then people just started handing me stuff, and it just sort of grew from there. Honestly, the only way I could see somebody going into it would be to just approach people. You know, a lot of the most lucrative projects I've worked on have been for sports figures. You know, I did one for a basketball player, a lot of politicians. I just finished one up for somebody that was almost our president. That's coming out in about another 6 months. You know, so I approach a lot, or I used to approach a lot of people like that. So if you have people around you, like, you know, go up to them. You know, if it's somebody that you feel could have a book out there or should have a book out there and doesn't, have that conversation with them. You know, when you're asking for that autograph at the, you know, at the football stadium or whatever, you know, bring it up. You know, you got a couple seconds to try and talk to them, just like anything else. And worst thing they're going to do is say no. But, you know, you never know. They might say, you know, I've been thinking about that, but I have no clue how to write a book. And you just hand them your email address and just kind of go from there. You have to throw those feelers out. And once you get, you do that a couple of times, if you write one or two of them, you get a reputation for it. Your name starts getting passed around. And that's kind of the boat that I was in, you know, where people start looking for you because you've done it before. So that's the only way I could think of where you could really break into it.
Nice. All right, let's see if we can get, I want to see if we can get both of Holger's questions in since Holger is new here. So see if we can get both these in real quick, then we can call it a day. So first question is, if you break it down in a rough estimate, how much of your working time, how much of your working time on any day do you spend on writing versus publishing, meaning like marketing, preparing the book pages on the platforms and such? Also, related question, what is the first thing you'd outsource? Jay, let's start. I know your answer is going to be interesting because you time block. So, like, you don't necessarily spend time doing all those things every single day.
Well, I'll tell you what else is going to be different about my response is that I'm the odd man out here because you guys make your, I think you make most of your revenue from your book royalties, and I don't. I make most of my revenue through author services. So it doesn't make sense for me to be focusing on my writing every single day. In fact, a lot of my day is spent working with clients, having Zoom calls, tending to my author community. So I think the assumption in the question is, you know, if you are publishing fiction, how much time should you be spending on the writing part? And so for me, I don't know, like I don't feel like my response is going to be very helpful because I'm not living off my fiction.
JD, what about you?
Yeah, so I'm an ASPE, so my schedule is very, very rigid as far as what I do every day. First thing I always do is knock out my words. So I'm usually in my chair at my desk about 7:30 or so in the morning. By 8 o'clock, I'm writing, and I usually knock out my 2,000 to 3,000 words by 11. I purposely don't block anything out time-wise until after 12 o'clock. So I've got a scheduling system, and my assistant knows, my publishers know, the only time you can book me for anything is between 12 and 2:30. So any foreign interview, anything that I have to do that's not writing is between that particular time. So like even like when we finish up here, like I've got a conference call about one of our film projects. Like they, you know, they're in California, so it's like it's a weird time for them to have to book, but they know they have to fall within that window. That works for me. The first thing that I outsourced was my social media stuff. Because I still to this day have no clue whether it moves the needle in any way whatsoever, but it was worthwhile for me to hire somebody to, you know, handle Facebook and handle Instagram and those kind of things for me, so I don't have to deal with it. You know, one of these days we'll see whether I keep that as part of the business model or not. But right now I'm paying somebody to do that.
Whenever, if I get to a point where I have to have social media, in other words, if I try to get a publisher and they want me to have it, that's going to be what I hire out because I'm not doing it. So. And I've personally seen my book sales go up since I quit doing it. So, like, that's all the data I have. But yeah, like, for me, you know, my schedule is kind of weird because I'm in have the dad mode thing going on because of my wife's job, you know. So I pretty much batch all my any kind of administrative and marketing stuff. Like, I batch all that on Wednesday and Friday afternoons. Because those are the two long days I have. Every other day, I'm just focused on writing and the time I have. Because I don't work full days those days. You know, and I understand the spirit of the question here, but I don't think there's no formula, there's no answer. Like, and I think the other thing to keep in mind is like, just, you know, the three of us are full time. You know, and well, even Jay said though, Jay's not necessarily a full time writer. You know, like. Does a lot of other things, you know, again, there's no formula and it's going to be different for everybody. And I don't write more than I did when I had a full-time job necessarily either. Like I think that's another misconception. Like there's only so many words I can do in a day, whether I have all the time to do it or not. Like my brain can only do so much. So I think that's an important thing to remember too.
Well, the other thing you just kind of touched on there is family time. You know, one of the things you have to really try to figure out when you, you know, work full time in any job, if you're doing it from home, is when to ring that quitting bell. Because a lot of people don't know when to do that. And in this world, it can get very difficult to do because, you know, like if, you know, in my case, I've got interview requests coming in from all around the world. So, you know, obviously there's different time zones going on. But I make all of them like that. You know, I've got a hard stop at, you know, 2:30, 3 o'clock every day, no matter what, because I want to go for a walk and a run. I want to, you know, relax. I want to sit down and spend the rest of the evening with my family. And I don't want to have to pick up, you know, from watching TV with my daughter or whatever it is we're doing to go and do something business related. So I think you have to figure out where to draw that line in the sand as well.
Cool. We want to try to get one more quick one in here, Jay. We have time for that?
Yeah, if it's the one I'm looking at, it's kind of related to this one anyway. So one,
yeah,
why not?
So it's the one at the bottom. So we'll just, is that the one you were looking at?
Oh, the when do you read one? Is that the one?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of built on this one. So do you want to?
We'll just roll with this one. So, yeah. So another question from Holger. He basically just wants to know, like, when do we read? Like, he, you know, asked how our, well, yeah, it's kind of built on the same thing. So when do you guys read? We'll end on this one.
So I stick to that same rigid schedule. So 2:30, 3 o'clock, I call it quits every day. So I fill the time after I'm done writing with reading, you know, like, so 12:45, if I don't have anything going on until 1:30, I'll pick up a book. The ones that I read in the early part of the day are the ones that, you know, at this point I'm kind of required to read. So they're the ARCs that come in to me from publishers and from my agent where they want me to blurb stuff. So it's kind of like work-related reading. At night when I want to relax, then that's, you know, usually right before bed, that's where I read something that I actually want to read. You know, we don't watch a whole lot of TV at night. We tend to read before bed. So that's where I'll pick up a book that I actually want to read and try to relax a little bit. So I mix it up.
Cool. Yeah, Jay? I have a similar situation. I have, for the podcast interviews, I have books I have to read. Now, sometimes there are also books I want to read, and that's nice. But let's be honest, not all of them. You know, I don't love every book I read. Nobody does. But those are sort of more like work. And then in the evening, the same way, I don't really, I watch maybe half an hour of TV while I eat lunch. That's pretty much it. And then at night, after I hang out with the family, maybe go for a walk with the wife, then I'll spend an hour or two reading, and that can be everything from fiction to nonfiction. And that's pretty much it for me. Like I outside of the workday, I don't do anything else on a screen, except that half hour of watching Netflix during lunch. And then I'm reading most of the other times.
Yeah. Reading is the first thing I do in a day and the last thing. So when I wake up in the morning, I read for a little bit before I hit the desk. And then I usually read a little bit before I go to bed. So, if I'm in like heavy process of editing a book though, I was talking to somebody about this the other day, my friend Brittany, I think, who's writing her first book. Like, I can't read. It's really hard for me to read when I'm, can you guys do that when you're in the editing phase of a book? Man, it's just a weird thing with me, maybe.
I can, but I think it's partly because of the way I break up my day. So, like, editing or reading ARCs, like, I see where you're coming from. Like, I'll pick up an ARC and I start moving commas around and correcting typos and things like that. But the stuff that I tend to read at night is usually pretty polished at that, you know, because it's done and gone and published.
So, JD, who's coming up next week on the podcast?
Next week, we've got Karen Slaughter. Now, if she's got a book coming out called False Witness. It releases July 20th. So I guess it just came out by the time this airs. Fantastic book, and it's one of the few that I've read recently that actually touches on COVID. So her characters are living in the same world that we are, all masked up and social distancing and all that fun stuff within her book, which was just fun to read because, you know, like, she's still describing facial expressions and all these different things going on, you know, but behind a mask, you know, which is a challenging thing to do. I don't know that I would do it, but most authors that I know at this point, they're kind of pretending COVID didn't happen as they're writing. You know, Stephen King, like in Billy Summers, he purposely moved the book forward 1 year and set it in 2019 just so he wouldn't have to deal with it. So yeah, cool read. And Karen is a lot of fun. You know, the first time I actually saw her do anything in person, she was interviewing Gillian Flynn at Thriller Fest. And they had that entire room just completely breaking up. Like, the one-liners that come out of her are crazy. Like, she's got one of the funniest senses of humor ever. So I'm looking forward to that one.
All right. Well, that's it. Let's right. Take us out, Jay.
Nice. Well, to our listeners, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and grab the free revision masterclass where you can see the storytelling process from beginning to end. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers, Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.